Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, how and why the U.S. can be accurately defined as a police state. My panelist today, Professor Andrew Kolin from Hamburg, New York. He is professor of political science at Hilbert College in Hamburg, New York, where he specializes in American political thought, civil liberties, U.S. foreign policy, and constitutional law. Much of his recent work has focused on the conflicts between state power and democracy, and the history of the United States turning into a police state. His latest book, published this year, is State Power and Democracy, Before and During the Presidency of George W. Bush, which traces the history of American politics for sowing the seeds for a national police state from the founding of the Republic to the present. He will be joined later in the program by Kevin Carson. He is a senior fellow, Carl Hess Scholar in social theory and research at the Center for a Stateless Society, an academic think tank that defends the ideals of social cooperation without aggression, oppression, or centralized authority. His articles frequently appear on the P2P Foundation blog and have been published by Counterpunch and Before It's News. He is the author of several books, including his latest, Homebrew Industrial Revolution, a low overhead manifesto. His more recent work, The Desktop Regulatory State, is available online, desktopregulatorystate.wordpress.com. I'd like to welcome both of you. Let's begin with you, Professor Andrew Kolin. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me back on your program.
I'm going to read a very brief piece that begins this by Benjamin Dangle from Counterpunch. The article is entitled, How the Pentagon Militarized the U.S. Police Force. He states, "Have no doubt, police in the United States are militarizing, and many communities, particularly those of color, the message is being received loud and clear. You are the enemy," writes Tom Nolan, who worked for 27 years in the Boston Police Department. He says many communities now look upon police as an occupying army. Their streets are more reminiscent of Baghdad or Kabul than the city in America. Now, this is no coincidence. Much of the equipment used by police forces on the streets of America today is, in fact, directly from the U.S. military. From a weaponization bonanza enabled by a little-known Pentagon program to an escalation in SWAT team deployments, the militarization of the U.S. police pose an increasing threat to the American public, as recently exhibited in Ferguson, Missouri. Now, behind this militarization is the Pentagon's 1033 program, created in the National Defense Authorization Act from 1997, which enables the Defense Department to provide surplus military equipment at a highly reduced cost to local police departments. The program was expanded after 9/11 and has led to the distribution of $4.2 billion in equipment. Police departments across the country now utilize some 500 military aircraft, 93,763 assault weapons, 432 mine-resistant ambush protection military vehicles, which cost around $700,000 new, and they're being sold to police departments for $2,800. $2,800, they cost $700,000 to the taxpayers. Now, an example of the program cited by The Guardian newspaper pointed to Richland County Sheriff in South Carolina obtaining a tank with the 360-degree rotating machine gun turrets. The tank was named the Peacemaker. Now, such unnecessary equipment is being utilized in cities and small towns across the country without sufficient oversight, proper training, or even public input. Following the outcry over police violence in Ferguson, the Pentagon still maintains that the weapon-selling program is good for the public. As Pentagon spokesman John Kirby told Newsweek, quote, "This is a useful program that allows for the reuse of military equipment that would otherwise be disposed of, that could be used by law enforcement agencies to serve their citizens. However, rather than serving citizens, this militarization of the police force has contributed to unnecessary violence, primarily against people of color and under the pretext of the so-called war on drugs. In June of this year, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, released a comprehensive report entitled War Comes Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing, which concludes that the U.S. police force has become, quote, excessively militarized through the use of weapons and tactics designed for the battlefield. And in this alarming trend, quote, unfairly impacts people of color and undermines individual liberties, and it has been allowed to happen in the absence of any meaningful public discussion. Now, while this escalation is ostensibly aimed at protecting the population from violent threats, the ACLU found that 62% of SWAT raids examined were used to search for drugs. Only 7% were used for hostages or barricade or active shooter scenarios. In conclusion, the use of SWAT teams has been skyrocketing over the past 45 years. According to Professor Peter Kraska of Eastern Kentucky University School of Justice Studies, in 1970s, they were used only a few hundred times a year. Now, every year, at least 50,000 times SWAT teams are used. Kraska estimates in some cases, they've even been used to break up illegal poker games, unlicensed barbershops, underage drinking, even having too long a grass in your front yard. Not able to pay a student loan, in comes breaking through the door the SWAT teams. In the case of one man, a suspected organizer of cockfights in Maricopa County, Arizona, SWAT team took over the man's living room and drove a tank into his yard, killing his dog and the chickens, highlighting the fact that this militarization is part of a wider assault of people of color in America. Alex Kane points out in Alternate that this violence is tied to the war on undocumented immigrants. Kane cites the ACLU's report on Arizona's infamously anti-immigrant sheriff, Joe Apero, who, in addition to acquiring 5 armored vehicles and 10 helicopters, has, quote, a machine gun so powerful it could tear through buildings on multiple city blocks. One step in the right direction following police violence in Ferguson would be to demilitarize the U.S. police force. As an unnamed Ferguson resident recently told BBC that the city's police officers, quote, it's power. They have the power they feel we don't. That's why they do these things. What they did to the young Michael Brown, that's unnecessary. That's overkill, end quote. First, I'd like your thoughts on that article and its overall arching message.
Yes. Yes, this unfortunate militarization of the police. I would like to begin with the present and kind of work our way backwards to the past. And when one thinks of the militarization of the police, it raises 2 questions. One, what is it? What is this militarization of the police? How can we define it? And second, why is this happening? Why is this accelerating in its pace? Now, regarding the first question, I would say to your listeners that what we can begin to define the militarization of the police as the police having become armed as a military force and an occupying army throughout the United States. And this militarization goes way beyond anything we can associate with normal police activities. Now, as to regard to the larger question of why is this happening, I would dare suggest that the militarization of the police is about regular police becoming political police. I want to further elaborate what I mean by tying the militarization of the police to political police, to them representing political police. I am suggesting that this militarization, which translates into a politicized police force, is that they definitely have a political agenda here, which I like to elaborate upon. If you look at, for instance, the very heavily armed SWAT teams, despicably breaking into people's homes at all hours of the day or night, using military-style tactics such as the use of this flash bang grenade to temporarily blind and deafen residents, only to serve a search warrant, by the way, which you correctly cited in the ACLU report is just about 60% of the time. And most often, some of these incredibly violent and intrusive searches are premised on the suspicion that someone might be in possession of a small amount of drugs. Now, how does this all happen again? And this makes us go back a little bit into the past, because one of the reasons for this enormous militarization, or what I call this growth of a political police, is that the use of federal funds have trickled down to the state and local police agencies, who have been able to really stockpile and create military arsenals. Now, again, this is justified for two reasons. One, to wage this ongoing, and I would characterize failed, war on drugs. And second, to wage a certainly equally troubling domestic war on terrorism post 9/11. Now, I'm sure as your listeners are well aware, if you consider the recent shooting of Michael Brown in Missouri, look how the police arrived on the scene as the people began to, for the most part, peacefully express their so-called right of civil disobedience. The SWAT arrived as literally an invading army and used SWAT teams with pretty sophisticated military equipment and at times attacked these unarmed civilians. Now this, of course, you should understand, this equipment included the use of APCs or armed personnel carriers. This is supposed to be used in combat zones. Now, again, how is this possible? As you rightfully mentioned in your opening remarks, this came from the Department of Defense 1033 program and also from the Department of Homeland Security grants to local law enforcement. Now, such militarization of policing has transformed police training from what I would consider it should be, ideally, a kind of social service, social welfare function. But now it is instead these police departments, they are trained with what I would call a warrior mentality in interacting with communities as if they're entering enemy territory. Now, what are they exactly doing? As again, I mentioned, and you mentioned as well, that this is amounts to raiding homes 60% of the times to search for drugs with these paramilitary tactics. Now, what is troubling and why I refer to this as a political police, this intrusive militarization going into people's homes with such armed personnel, there is absolutely no public oversight. There is no legal restraint exercised against such tactics. Now, understand why also I say these are political police forces. If you look at who they target, they tend to enter primarily into homes and businesses of people of color. That, the ACLU study, which I looked at recently, tends to bear out. You don't see SWAT teams going into white suburban neighborhoods and breaking down doors and throwing grenades into their homes. Obviously not. But putting aside the Fourth Amendment, which obviously is what these SWAT teams easily do, you must understand how they begin the process of forcefully breaking into anyone's home. This is called no-knock warrants, meaning that they do not have to announce who they are. They just bang your door down using these battering rams, and in they go, armed to the teeth. Now, what do they have that allows them to do this? This is an enormous array of military equipment and weapons. And all of this began to really proliferate nationally through the 1033 program in the 1990s as part of the so-called war on drugs. The U.S. Department of Defense would transfer military equipment to local law enforcement agencies through this program. Now, the really troubling aspect is by 1996, Congress made the program permanent, and as it is now. Now, if you look at the SWAT teams and the paramilitary units, they also, going back a bit in time to the past, to the 1960s, their first widespread use, and why I say again they are political police, was to quell unrest associated with civil disobedience. That had to do with anti-war movements, with demonstrations, civil rights. That's where we start to see them proliferating. And now they've expanded to which they began in the 70s and the 80s, to these search warrants for so-called drug investigations with this no-knock. And that means they do not have to provide any kind of what's called reasonable suspicion of even possible drug activities. Now, if you look at, again, these weapons, and I, given the limited amount of time, I don't want to get into all the particulars, but I can tell your listeners that these are weapons that have been used, the same kind of weapons in our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and those so-called wars on terrorism. Now, let us talk about what's going on currently in the Obama administration. That is, according to Pentagon studies themselves, police departments have received tens of thousands of machine guns, 200,000 rounds of ammunition, thousands of pieces of camouflage, night vision equipment, hundreds of silencers. Now, what could that be possibly used for? Armored cars and even aircraft. Now, if you look at, again, given the whole range of this military hardware, you open up and look inside a police armory, they might as well resemble a military storage depot. So these political SWAT teams use this equipment now literally tens of thousands of times for very routine operations. And I want to bring to your attention, your listeners, how absurd the SWAT teams have been and that they are attacking really ordinary citizens. They appeared very heavily armed and masked in the state of Louisiana to raid a nightclub. This is in 2006 as part of a, listen carefully, a liquor inspection. In the state of Florida in 2010, officers of SWAT with guns drawn carried out raids, which you mentioned, on barbershops. Now, what were the charges that were eventually leveled? It seems somewhat sadly comical. The charges that they were prosecuted on were, quote-unquote, barbering without a license. So here's the current state of affairs now because of this proliferation of these SWAT teams and this militarization. We have now statistically 260 law enforcement agencies in 26 states that have become excessively militarized. But I do want to return to an elaborate, which I feel is of utmost importance, why I call this militarized police a political police. And these are the reasons I want to mention. I have about, if I can get these all talked about seven reasons. First, I want to say they are political because their use is arbitrary. They're used without a clear purpose other than to expand the power and the authority of the police. And in so doing, this militarizing police harms and sometimes kills innocent people without getting into particular cases here. Now, secondly, another reason that I refer to them as political police forces, they are terrorizing communities, especially when regular police, not militarized police, should be at work in communities. And that means that people see these forces coming and they become fearful. So they're terrorizing communities. They're fearful to engage in civil disobedience, knowing that what force will be they will have to confront, such excessive force on very often peaceful protesters. Now, the third reason for calling them political police is that these militarized police forces are what I call self-perpetuating, is that once they get their hands on these weapons, they want to continue to get their hands on more and more of this stuff. Now, fourth, I say they're political police because it is highly profitable. Now, I don't mean just in terms of state and local police agencies. There is a market here. There are military contractors who have found a market for their products, and that is on the state and local police departments. Now, fifth reason this is political police forces is that what you have, unfortunately, and why, again, I call them that, is that this militarization coincides with police militarization in general. Now, my final reason, which I feel is probably, if I had to put it at the top of all the important reason, is that the militarization of police gives people a political function which they should not have, and that is to repress dissent. Now, if you look at the event in Ferguson with the Brown shooting, this certainly has raised concerns over the militarization of police, certainly to the extent of, as I've been starting to follow this, that Senator McCaskill is to hold hearings on the militarization of police. But I do want to conclude and to say this for the attention of your listeners. I do consider the militarization of the police as a symptom of a much larger problem. What I mean to say is that these political police forces, because they are so militarized, are part of that larger problem I call the American police state. And I say that the roots of this American police state has been and continues to be a government which has formed institutions which are, in a word, authoritarian. And what I mean by this authoritarianism, which we see through this militarized police, they are in the business of controlling people's minds and bodies. Now, if you look at institutional mind control on the federal, trickling down to the federal and state levels, there is what I call an obsessive secrecy built into the federal government. If you were to look into, which we don't have time to talk at any length, about the activities of the NSA and certainly the CIA. Now, these particular federal agencies, and there are hundreds of them that has proliferated post 9/11, make use of mass surveillance to collect information on all of us, people who are activists and people who are just going about their daily business. And this is quite sophisticated technology to collect our thoughts and movements. If any of your listeners, and I'm sure many of them have cell phones, you should consider your cell phone as nothing more than a tracking device, which police departments are increasingly looking to use. Now, this militarized police, then, I say, is part of a national police state because it functions in accordance to a declared and undeclared states of national emergency. This often is how these militarized police units are drawn in. We say there's a crisis. We say there is a state of emergency. We have no choice. We have to bring them in. That's police state thinking right there. And I would also argue there are other police state attributes that one could identify with these militarized police units. They operate, as many of these units do, as I made some comments this evening, outside of legal restraints. That's police state stuff. The police state is and the functions in the absence of any legal restraint on police forces. Now, they also continue to manufacture threats. That's how they go into communities, the main one being, of course, terrorism, the other being the war on drugs. Certainly that is to justify that these threats are so extreme we must be literally armed to the teeth. Now, if again you look at the police forces, and we saw aspects of this certainly in Ferguson when they went in and were attacking these more or less peaceful demonstrators, we saw what they did to reporters and we saw what they did to other protesters. They pretty much practice a standard police state practice, and that is preventive detention. They detain them without cause because they, in their judgment, determined that their actions might be some future threat. Now, this is all part and parcel, again, of the United States after 9/11, preventive detention. This is not just being used by military police. We still have Guantanamo Bay. We've had all the abuses before and then even after 9/11 at Abu Ghraib. And for this to function, and if you look at the pretty sophisticated technology, certainly the communication apparatus is used by the militarized police forces, that's something police states do as well, to keep an eye on what the people are doing. And if you look at the militarized police, something I had mentioned in my earlier comments, pretty much standard police practice is people being monitored for no reason to be monitored. They are increasingly using drones. Drones is now pretty common inside and, of course, increasingly outside the United States. And so these militarized police forces, as a symptom of the larger police state, are using what I call extraordinary measures against unarmed and, for the most part, peaceful U.S. citizens. And that includes they have, sadly, and in a very scary sense, a right to shoot and kill any perceived threat to the United States. They operate in accordance to the NDAA, that is the National Defense Authorization Act, which, if you look at sections 1021 and 1031, I would urge your listeners to do so. It allows the president, allows police forces to simply target and kill even U.S. citizens inside and outside the United States if they're perceived threats. So this kind of militarized police force is certainly trying to send the message that it can attack anyone without much restraint to eliminate any kind of unrest, any kind of civil disobedience. And the SWAT has been also increasingly used to quell dissenters. If you look at another application, just certainly relevant to talking about a militarized police, look no further than, since you're broadcasting from New York City, as I'm sure you're well aware, what the New York Police Department has been practicing for some time now, this stop and frisk program. Simply arbitrarily stopping people, they have no reason to stop them, especially minorities, and ask them to show papers, and to simply hassle them. That's what that's a police state practice. Okay? Again, this is part of the larger national police, national what I call security state, that places emphasis on social control over civil liberties.
That was quite an introduction.
Yes.
So what you have done here is you began by laying down the conditions by which a nation can accurately be perceived as a police state. And then you shared with us some of the most defining characteristics that are now being witnessed in the relationship between the executive government, the military, and local and state law enforcement. And then we're also seeing the Obama policies that indicate there is a concentration of power occurring that is overriding the remaining threads of democracy upon which the nation was founded. After all it would require would be the Attorney General and the President of the United States simply saying that we've had enough, to rescind the order, to get back all that militarized equipment, and then to implement a program to put in every police department unarmed individuals who are there to go into communities and to work cooperatively with the community to find out what kind of social issues it's dealing with, whether it's drugs or gangs, and then find ways of trying to bring some adjustment to the benefit of the citizens of that. If you have a problem in a school, you don't go in and arrest a bunch of kids. And that was being done in Pennsylvania, by the way. Over 1,000 young kids were arrested for simple things like truancy, being late for class, and put into prison because two judges were found to be receiving kickbacks from the private prison system. So every kid that went in, they got money. I think it was $1.7 million they ended up getting. Now, they were both convicted, but not before they destroyed over 5,000 young people's lives. But what really shocked me, and I put it up today on my website, was a photograph of little kids, we're talking about 5 and 6 year olds, handcuffed, getting onto a sheriff's bus because they were going to juvenile detention. They had been found guilty by these judges of some violation that done historically would never have happened. Historically, first of all, there would have been some form of social services and counseling that would have resolved the issue. And secondly, the police would never have handcuffed a young person like that. Now you have one girl falling asleep in school because she had sleep apnea, and a police officer coming up and bashing her head and then arresting her. That would never have happened. You have police in schools with zero tolerance, so the normal behavior of children is now considered a criminal act. That would never have happened historically. And the war on drugs is a complete farce at every level. And in a legitimate society, a legitimate democracy, they would never have a war on drugs. We saw what the war on alcohol and prohibition did. It brought in organized crime, La Cosa Nostra, and all them from Meyer Lansky and Costello and the Colombo family, all of the major crime families, the Lucci family, they all came from the Gallo family. They all came from prohibition. Al Capone came from prohibition. Thousands of murders and exploitation. So in a civil society, you don't say one highly toxic substance, such as smoking, is legal, but marijuana is illegal. Now, and you don't say drinking, which kills a million liver cells, brain cells, heart cells, and kidney cells with every hard drink, is legal, but taking some other substance is illegal. You have to have an educational programming showing the health and disease risks of taking any substance, but ultimately you should have a freedom of choice as a society to decide what you're going to imbibe and what you're going to put into your body. And we don't allow that now. We're very selective. We don't look at 88,000 deaths in Mexico from the war on drugs there. We don't look at the tens of billions of dollars lost. All we look at is if you're a person of color, you can be stopped and searched. If you've done nothing wrong, and the police want to arrest you more often than not. Have you noticed how many police are arresting people for resisting arrest, but they've not done anything wrong? So there is no, they committed a crime, they stole something, they hijacked a car. No, it's just resisting arrest. But it makes no sense. Why would you arrest someone for resisting arrest when they've done nothing wrong to be arrested for? So, and how they treat people of color is completely different. You do not see any search and seizures down on Wall Street. You do not see the police there watching people as they come out of Goldman Sachs. You don't see them watching people coming out of synagogues on Park Avenue or churches in Scarsdale. You don't see them stopping people as they're exiting a Broadway theater. Now, you should if you really are saying, oh, we're not profiling. Well, they're lying. Yes, they are. Because I'm not seeing anyone standing outside of mansions in Darien, Connecticut, Greenwich, Connecticut, and stopping and searching billionaires and hedge funds and equity partnerships. I don't see that. Now, maybe I missed it. Maybe I missed the SWAT teams bursting into apartments, including the Koch brothers' apartment on Park Avenue. No, but it didn't happen. And when they do this, then it's suddenly not in the news. Ferguson was the exception. Because for every person that gets shot and who is black or Latino, there are a thousand who get shot that nobody hears about. So then we learn from you that this has got an agenda. So in order to put this in proper perspective, I'd like to ask you a follow-up question before we go to our other guest. Sure. You even have FEMA, the USDA, the FDA, the EPA, have their own policing and even SWAT teams. This is a part of the gift of the National Guard and of the personnel of police departments are expanding with all kinds of specialties. One question is, where do you get all these men and women to serve in these many functions, plus their training? So do you have any information about the standard requirements for young men to become police officers and whether or not many who are entering domestic law enforcement are being recruited out of the armed forces? And if so, how in the world would you understand whether someone has already got emotional damage and may be suffering from psychiatric burnout or some kind of psychological burnout, requiring psychiatric drugs or suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or paranoia or violent natures? And because we are now seeing that the police officers have twice the domestic violence against their spouses as do the rest of the population. And so when you end up seeing someone on the street, instead of talking through an issue and not even having an arrest, but rather a person jogging on a campus in Austin, Texas, just jogging, a woman was arrested, thrown to the ground, beaten up. For what? Because she jaywalked? This is absurd, and yet this is now the new normal. Would you address these, please?
Yes, that is all true, and I couldn't agree more, and certainly I hope I've said as much from my preceding comments. But I do want to add this, and again, not that these developments can be understood just entirely in terms of that they're being negative and this is continued. I do want to introduce, and if I could put it this way, as kind of a qualified hope, that if you look in historically in many police states, this you could say from whether we talk about the Italian one, the German one, the ones in Latin America, wherever you go, look what tends to happen to them all over time. They tend to become what I call dysfunctional. In other words, they tend to break down. They tend not, more they tend to exert power that sooner or later there is increasing resistance. We start to see, and again, I would dare not predict when and how this would happen in the United States, there tends to be a democratic upsurge. There tends to be resistance. There tends to be those who want to introduce principles of law to restrain, and that's where I think it could head. I don't know, again, when and how it may head, but again, if there's any basis of comparison for other police states, they simply cannot be maintained. They cannot be permanent because they're simply too undemocratic. They operate in secret and they don't have support. And therefore, this kind of system will not be permanent. I say that to your listeners and to you.
I hope not, but look at the Stasi, look at Stalin, look at Mao, look at the different police states in South America. It was only when the regime was changed that they stopped. And I'm not seeing regime change because Americans, around 40% who vote, are either voting corporate Democrat or corporate Republican. They're not voting for Gary Johnson. They're not who we had on this program. They're not voting for Jill Stein or Rocky Anderson or Ralph Nader or Ron Paul, who I've had on this program, or Dennis Kucinich. People are truly independent, care about our rights. Instead, they're voting for fascism, inverted totalitarianism. And so I'm not optimistic. Now, what I do think, and I'm willing certainly to acknowledge this is merely a hypothesis, but I believe that nothing, absolutely zero, nothing will come from Ferguson. Instead, I believe that this will continue. I believe that what will happen is at some point in the future, when I do not know, that there will be a situation where a Caucasian person, and it may seem like an insignificant incident, maybe have had a home foreclosure. The marshals go to evict the person. The person doesn't want to leave. A SWAT team is called. The person is shot or a family killed. And that will be the flashpoint, because what you're dealing with then is you're not dealing with civil rights leaders. You're not dealing with a highly educated, highly articulate African-American Latino a professional class that can come in and ameliorate a situation, calm it down. You're dealing with poor working class whites who are armed. You've got 50 million of them. And these people already are watching what's happening. And it is not about race. It is about class. I believe that the wars in the future will be about class, not race. And they already are working two and three jobs. They're deeply in debt. Some of them are taking payday loans that are charging them up to 1,800% interest compounded per year, even though they're 30-day loans. People, over 7 million Americans, have had their homes foreclosed on with four people per home. You're dealing with anywhere between 20 to 30 million people who have been thrown out of their homes with no consideration. And those homes are now owned by the different hedge funds and equity partnerships that are charging outrageous rents or putting them into tranches and selling them as securitized rental properties. Once again, what the same people caused the problems with the subprime mortgage are doing it with repossessed homes. So these people are always being victimized. These are the people that have 18 million hungry children that go to bed at night, food limited. They're skipping meals, sometimes for a whole day. These are 1.6 million kids don't even have a home to go to. There are now 100 million Americans just above, at, or below the poverty level. There are 4.7 million Americans who are living on less than $2 a day. You heard me right. The same financial requirements we use in Africa, Bangladesh, and India to show abject poverty under $2 a day. That's 4.7 million Americans. Or put another way, if you took every single person out of Queens and Brooklyn, you could fill every single one of their homes with one of these people living under $2 a day, and yet they're invisible. 12 million senior citizens, invisible. The difference is you never, and I repeat, you never have an armed group of African Americans or Latinos coming to challenge the police. You might have some foolish looters, which you will have, but they do not represent even a fraction of the people of color who are willing to protest in a civil manner as strongly and voraciously as they can. You won't have the same thing when it comes to whites. You're going to have a lot of angry people who are armed, they're trained. At least 15 to 20% of them are former military. And then you're going to have a pushback the likes of which this country has never seen. Your thoughts on this, please.
Yes, I'd like to elaborate in this direction from what your comments are. In a sense, if I could characterize what you just said, is that in a way we should expect the unexpected. And I would suggest with the militarization of police, with the police state practices, that is, again, if I can compare it to elsewhere, they tend to eventually, because the emphasis there is to continually expand their power and to increase their control, they tend to go too far. They overreach. And when they then to expand by way of overreach, and they tend to attack the privileged, those who are basically supporting by their passivity what they're doing, then there tends to be what I would call the seeds of revolt. And the resistance to police states tended to start from the middle levels and work its way up to, you know, those privileged. And then what you start to see after there is resistance, after the privileged are targeted, that they tend to try to make contact and reach down and mobilize the masses. And this seems to be the pattern. Now, again, I wouldn't dare speculate that this will happen in the United States, but I would suggest it might happen. This could be the way. But I do agree with what you said, that as long as it, you know, the disaffected, the less privileged and others who don't really have a power base, they're going to ignore them. And I do agree that I don't think much will also come out of Ferguson other than a lot of, you know, lip service, and because there's nothing structurally. I even think the McCaskill hearings are going to be kind
nothing.
Of a
dog,
show.
Dog and pony show. All of the hearings in Washington are foolish. Nothing ever happens. Hold your thoughts, Professor Andrew Kolin. Let's go over now and say hello to Kevin Carson. Kevin, thank you for patiently sitting back and listening to this part of the program. It's going to be to you now.
Well, hello. Nice to be on your show.
I want to quickly review some statistics with listeners again. The Pentagon's influence over local police departments, $4.2 billion in military equipment has been provided to police departments, 500 military aircraft, 100,000 assault weapons, 432 mine-resistant ambush-protected military vehicles, and yet they're given these. And now my question is, what role is the private sector of the larger military-industrial complex played in supplying military surplus to domestic law enforcement, and how are they benefiting from this alliance between local police and the Pentagon?
Well, corporate capitalism's always had a chronic crisis tendency towards excess investment capital without any profitable outlet for investment. You've got more capital sitting around than there are profitable opportunities for, just because the system shifts so much wealth to the property classes who do the most investment and saving, that they've got more money piled up sitting on top of than they know what to invest it in. So, and the system also has a tendency towards idle productive capacity, because there's not enough demand to keep the lines running at full capacity all the time. So the military-industrial complex is a way for the government to use up some of the excess capacity on those assembly lines at taxpayer expense, and create additional industrial capacity that the property classes can invest in. And in 1984, I think it was in Emanuel Goldstein's book, he said that was the beauty of warfare, is that it could take all of this excess production that would otherwise destroy the system with depression and either sink it to the bottom of the ocean or blow it up into the stratosphere. And I would add, in peacetime, when the stuff becomes obsolete or they've got too much surplus hardware, they can give it away to local police forces and then buy the next generation of equipment. So, you know, everything they give away to local police forces is clearing out military inventory that can be replaced in the future by ordering more from contractors.
Many liberals and progressives argue that the illegal institutionalization of domestic policing and widespread surveillance of Americans was implemented by the Bush administration. Now, this argument would claim that Bush was a kind of anomaly in presidential history. However, you put forth the case that the seeds of America's emerging into a police state were planted much earlier. So what are some of the early signs and indicators and policies and actions pre-Bush that have contributed most to Obama's almost dictatorial powers he has cloaked himself in? And also share a little bit about how Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon created the basic structure, such as the Civil Disturbance Plan 55-2 that would eventually give rise to the kind of police state we live in today?
Yeah, the motivation for behind all of this police militarization really goes back to the 60s with the big urban riots and large-scale anti-war demonstrations. And that scared the heck out of U.S. elites. And in response, you know, they conducted a bunch of white ribbon commissions on the causes of the violence and started putting a lot more planning into law enforcement and military contingencies for things like that in the future. Under LBJ and Nixon both, they set up contingency plans like garden plot for cooperation between federal, state, and local forces in the event of a domestic civil disturbance, and creating military manuals for dealing with civil disturbances. It's interesting that one of the first, if not the first, laws against open carry of weapons in the United States was passed in California and signed into law by Ronald Reagan, and it was done in direct response to Huey Newton and other leaders of the Black Panthers Party in Oakland going to Sacramento and marching up the steps of the state legislature with AK-47s, and also the Black Panthers armed cop watch patrols in Oakland. Under the Reagan administration in California also, he was one of the first governors to introduce widespread use of SWAT teams by local police, and he was one of the most enthusiastic cooperators with the federal government in these in carrying out exercises to simulate the civil disturbance plans. It's interesting that his head of the National Guard when he was governor was Louis Jafrida, who later became the head of FEMA under Ronald Reagan, and Jafrida was the person responsible for coordinating cooperation between the California National Guard and state and local police forces under garden plot exercises. And, for, you know, from that point on, it just ratcheted upward. The war on drugs started under Nixon in the 70s. It was intensified under Reagan in the 80s, and that just served as a pretext for basically destroying the 4th, 5th, and 6th Amendments. And then the militarization of police forces got further underway with the war on terror starting in the 90s and really went up after 9/11. So it's just been a continuous process. And one of the main things driving it is the need for domestic population control.
The war on terror has now expanded well beyond that of the bunch of military Islamic radicals hiding in the mountains and deserts in the Middle East and North Africa. Increasingly, peaceful, proactive organizations such as environmental, anti-fracking, and anti-nuclear, and animal rights, and anti-free market capitalist groups and organizations have been rounded up under the War on Terror umbrella. So when we look back at Reagan, and there was already plans, as you just mentioned, to implement martial law on Americans in the event of a government claiming a national emergency, whether real or fabricated. Can you speak a little on the impact of the policies during the Reagan era and how that impacted the militarized policing of demonstrations and protests such as Occupy Wall Street today that are becoming more frequent? And by the way, we have found out from WikiLeaks that every single Occupy group in the United States had infiltrators, they had provocateurs, and in Houston, they actually had snipers on the buildings ready to take out, at the command, which was not given, fortunately, the Occupy leaders, even though it was completely peaceful, and there was nothing they were doing that violated constitutional laws, but we saw how they were treated, pepper sprayed, beaten, arrested, And so now anyone in the United States, any human being that protests globalization, the NAFTA, GATT, Trans-Pacific Partnership, World Trade Organization, International Monetary Fund, any of the corporate interests in the United States, any of the lulls or overreach of the police is now considered no better than a terrorist suspect and is put on watch lists. They have vans that go to every demonstration and do scans of people's retinas, so they have retinal examinations so they can identify people. They are listening on every phone call. They are collecting data on those that they consider leaders. They are looking to see if they have porn and what kind of porn. They're looking through all their old emails to see if there's anyone that they were in conflict with so they can have someone that can testify against a person's character. They have gone to great lengths, to make sure that anyone in the future that may represent any challenge to their authority or power is contained. Your thoughts, please, Kevin.
Well, on the Reagan administration, the two things that come to mind are the same Louis Jufrida I mentioned before when he was the head of FEMA, carried out martial law exercises under garden plot. I think it was called Readiness Exercise 83 and Readiness Exercise 84. If I recall correctly, Oliver North was involved in some way. And I think the basic scenario being simulated was the aftermath of the fall of some Central American country to communism and a large-scale influx of refugees across the border, followed by, possible civil disturbances by domestic anti-war protesters, and it included provisions for warrantless detention of people that were considered national security risks and so forth. And the other thing is that the war on drugs got going in earnest under Reagan, mainly because of just the additional propaganda effort he put into it. I read in one of Noam Chomsky's books, I can't remember which one. I think it was the one on the media, maybe one of those. But he said that before Ronald and Nancy Reagan started their propaganda campaign against drugs, illegal drug use ranked very low on the list. In some cases, didn't show up on the list at all of major concerns of the American people, of problems that needed to be dealt with. But after the propaganda campaign got underway, it moved right up to the top of the list, along with the threat of nuclear war. So it was just a manufactured controversy to make people afraid and support giving more authority and weapons and resources to the police.
Kevin, I have time for just one quick question, please. Do you have any knowledge about the FEMA camps and what they intend to be used for? They exist. That's a matter of historical fact. But we do not know what they were created for. Do you have any idea?
I'm really not sure. I mean, I tend to be skeptical of any conscious, conspiratorial motivation, because I think in the most case, government's just motivated by bureaucratic interests and inertia more than anything else. But once the government creates something for one reason, it can be repurposed pretty quickly if the people at the top decide they need to take action about something. And the U.S. government's had all kinds of surplus military property, including housing on abandoned military bases and stuff like that, okay, Going back a long time. Fort Chaffee here in Arkansas, down at Barling or Van Buren is a good example of that. I think the primary purpose of the FEMA camps is, at least, supposedly for large-scale refugees or illegal aliens, so-called.
Okay.
But
well, I appreciate
if there was a national emergency, sure.
Well, my final statement is our streets should be a place for businesses, families to be safe and be able to relax, and not for militarized police operations and street surveillance and indiscriminate stop and frisk, such as New York City, where anyone can be detained by policemen and searched without cause. I believe for the first time the American public throughout the media have witnessed the extent and show of force of local and state police departments and what they're capable of with the recent demonstrations in Ferguson, Missouri. The residents of towns and cities across the nation are now seeing what many of their police departments have become without their real knowledge, and what should be the events of Ferguson being telling the American public, and why should Americans be very deeply concerned. I want to thank Kevin Carson, Senior Fellow, the Carl Hess Scholar in Social Theory and Research at the Center for a Stateless Society, and also for Professor Andrew Colon, Professor of Political Science and Constitutional Law at Hilbert College. Thank you both, and I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Whoa. All things ain't what they used to be.